Hello, I'm Jane Crowther and welcome to the subscriber version of Inside Total Film. And as always, thank you for taking out a subscription with us. We love having you on board. Today I'm joined by our editor-at-large, Jamie Graham.
Hello.
Hello, Jamie. And critic and contributor, Ashanti Onker. Hello.
Hi.
Hi. This week we are talking Edgar Wright's latest, Last Night in Soho, Rebecca Hall's directorial debut, Passing, horror Antlers, and music documentary, or is it, The Nowhere Inn? But before we get to that, though, what have you guys been watching apart from that? Ashanti.
Oh, gosh, I've been watching loads. I feel like I live in the cinema. I need, actually, what I need is a little home in Soho. You know, that's what I need.
You need a crash pad, darling, yeah. Don't you?
That's exactly what I need. Soho Hotel, please give me a room and I'll be very happy.
Yeah. Or you could get a room at 8 Gower Place, like in Last Night in Soho, and just live above a house and above a restaurant.
Too scary. I couldn't do it. I couldn't do it. My dad used to live around that area when he studied at UCL. But I just wouldn't. After seeing that film, and we won't give away any spoilers.
No.
Give me Dean Street, please.
Okay, highfalutin' Ashanti there. What have you been watching in Soho?
Well, actually, I went out of Soho, out of my comfort zone yesterday night to see Eternals at the Science Museum.
Cool.
They had set out this back entrance with this lawn with a big Eternals logo on it. And then you went in and there were all these people dressed up as various Marvel superheroes. So this was mainly fans, I would say. And they've got the IMAX screen at the Science Museum. And, this is nice. I call it the rise of the multicolored superhero because it's something we just haven't been seeing. Those comics weren't really written with 2021 in mind, I suppose. And this film seems to have it all. And I'm just happy it's happening, you know, at the MCU and, you know, Kamala Khan's Miss Marvel's coming up and I'm really looking forward to that. And, you know, we saw Falcon and the Winter Soldier, or should I say Captain America and the Winter Soldier. And that felt really good to see because we're seeing a big transition in what MCU are giving us as fans. And I saw Spencer, and as Jane had said when she had first seen it, I mean, give the awards to Kristen Stewart. She is fantastic. I mean, this was our beloved kind of people's Princess Diana. And for an American actress to embody that, I was so skeptical going in, and I came out feeling like, yes, she really gave us a glimpse of, you know, how trapped Princess Diana felt in Sandringham. And all I can say is, if I was in Sandringham, I would eat the sandwiches, the lobsters and the cake.
Oh, yeah.
That are there is what I can say.
I would have been straight in that fridge with all the puddings.
Same.
That's and where you would have found me.
You know, and I won't give another spoiler, but after I ate that, I would have just gone to sleep is what I'm going to say. The card counter is another one I'm very excited about. All those thirst tweets about Oscar Isaac. I don't see it. I mean, he's in Dune at the moment. He's having a moment. He's also in Scenes from a Marriage.
Yeah.
You know, and I mean, he'll be in Moon Knight, which I'm really excited about, but I don't particularly fancy him. But I've seen the thirst tweets on Twitter and it's like, this is interesting.
Ashanti, is it okay to do that? Because if we were doing that about a female actor, would we be happy with it? It's, some of them kind of are a bit much, aren't they?
It's icky for me. I have to say I find it a little icky and I'm seeing so much of it and thinking, what's going on? I don't understand it. You know, what can I say? That's the internet of today, isn't it?
It certainly is.
Can I give you one more?
Okay,
one
cool.
more to yep. say? There's Dr. Brain on Apple TV. And this one is based on a Korean web animation. It's a sci-fi thriller. And obviously on the back of Squid Game being so popular, this one's hit Apple TV Plus, and it's actually really interesting.
Okay, that's a good recommendation. Jamie, what have you been watching?
I've been a bit in the past. So I only saw Dune for the first time this week because I couldn't get to a screening. So I saw that for the first time at the cinema, at my local cinema, and loved it. It's quite a packed cinema, actually, and it played really well. It was just deathly quiet. Everyone, all these worries about like all can teenagers into the TikTok, you know, generation, will they be able to sit for 2.5 hours and watch a film like that? All those fears were put to rest because you could hear a pin drop. People were really into it. So that was a great experience. And then Talking of Scenes from a Marriage, I've been catching up on that. I started that last night, the first couple of episodes, which I really liked. And I love the way it's very modern and set here and now, because they had to update it. I mean, the original Bergman one in 1973 is one of my favourite films. It's
all five hours of it.
5 hour TV version. There is a 3 hour theatrical cut, which obviously takes some of the guts out of it. But the 5 hour version is just one of the greatest things ever, ever made. So my bar is high on this, but I like what they've done with it so far. So I shall continue with that. And then the other thing I've been watching this week, this may surprise people to know I'm a bit of a Harry Potter fan. And that may surprise people because everyone knows me for my horror, etc., etc. But every single year, also because my wife is a massive Potter fan, I rewatch all 8 films. We always do a marathon every single year in the build up to Christmas. We watch them all again. And we started them this week, and I've actually watched the first 5 in the last 3 days. So I'm on a roll with Harry Potter's and getting back into that world, and have enjoyed it tremendously, especially the 3rd one, which has always been my favourite, Azkaban, Prisoner of Azkaban.
Well, you should get yourself out to the Warner's Harry Potter experience.
I've done it twice.
It's Christmas at the moment. They've got like a winter wonderland. You need to go for the Christmas version.
The first time I went in the lead up to Christmas, and it was amazing because the Great Hall was completely decked out, you know, like it is in the first film at Christmas. And it was just really magical when that moment where the kind of screen goes up and you're suddenly in the Great Hall. It was a real transportative wow moment. So that's what I've been doing. What about you, Jane? What have you been watching?
Well, I think you're copying me because I told you to watch
Scenes from a Marriage,
didn't I? I said you should watch it.
I wanted to see it anyway. It was on my watch list.
No.
You tipped me over the edge. I'll give you that.
So, yes, I watched the entirety of it in a sort of big session. And again, it's Oscar Isaac again. People have gone mad for this and first tweets about this as well. But I think it's really interesting to see him and Jessica Chastain, who've worked together a lot through the ages and also went to university together and studied drama together. And you really get that sort of sense of their lived-in relationship from this. And that's what I really like. I don't think I like either character very much, but maybe I'm not supposed to. But I just like watching them bounce off each other and work with each other. And that seems to be the most special part of it. So yes, I would highly recommend. And Jamie, I want to discuss when you finished some points, but not here. Shall we move on?
Okay, let's do it.
Shall we go up west then? It's this.
Last night, I saw something in my dreams. Was a girl.
And you are?
Sandy.
So this is Last Night in Soho, Edgar Wright's latest. Jamie, set it up for us. What is happening in Soho?
So what it is, it starts off that there's a young fashion student called Eloise, who is played by Thomasin McKenzie, who's a very sort of shy, retiring, quiet type, lives in Cornwall, loves her grandmother very, very much. And she goes off to London to study fashion. Her grandmother's just died, so she's grieving as well. And she goes off to London. And when she gets to London, you know, she finds it, like a lot of us do when we first get to London, a big, cold, impenetrable city, which is really quite scary. But you go there thinking, oh, I'll pursue my dreams. The streets are glittering with gold. And then you get there and can feel really lonely and alienated. So she's kind of going through this, and she's really, really into 60s stuff. Like, she's always listening to her grandmother's record collection from the 60s. She loves the fashion of the 60s, like Carnaby Street, swinging 60s. And suddenly she is kind of transported. I don't want to give too much away, but she finds herself almost nightly transported back to the 60s, back to swinging London. And she gets really interested, almost obsessed with this woman there called Sandy, who is a young wannabe singer played by Anya Taylor-Joy, who is going on her own journey, much like Eloise now is in the present day, but she's arrived in London. She wants to be a singer. She's determined to be the new Cilla Black. She meets a sort of sharp-suited man about town, played by Matt Smith, who promises he knows the right people and can kick in the right doors and make her a star. And then things go horribly wrong. And I'll leave it there.
This is quite sort of giallo, isn't it, for Edgar? It's sort of lurid, blood-splattered, 60s, heightened. Did you like him going into that genre?
For the most part, I did. I mean, Edgar's always been a massive, massive horror fan. I mean, obviously, Shaun of the Dead was his debut, but we're used to him having sort of lots of action, lots of comedy, you know, really sort of fast-paced, entertaining films. But beneath that, he's always been a massive horror fan. De Palma, Bava, Argento, all of those guys. You know, if you follow Echo on Twitter, you'll know how much he's into it. So he's always kind of wanted to make a film like this. And when he first started making it, he said, this is going to be my Repulsion. This is going to be my Don't Look Now.
Yeah.
Don't Look Now is actually a bit of a rogue reference, I think, because it's not like that in tone at all. Don't Look Now is very kind of somber.
More Suspiria, isn't it?
And haunting. Yeah, this is more heightened and more kind of entertaining, and it's got all the stuff you expect from Edgar. It's got the music, the constant 60s music, it's got the sinuous camera moves, the whirling camera, the excitement, the colors, the production design is absolutely incredible. They dressed up Soho back to the 60s. Most of it is done in camera. There's not many special effects shots. So from all that viewpoint, it's dazzling. And there's sequences in this film that are mind-blowing, where it's just Edgar as a filmmaker and his love of cinema just comes through, it pulsates. My problem with the film is I think in the final third, and I don't want to give anything away, it goes in a direction which, while you're watching it, is quite satisfying and you kind of have this punchy air moments of almost retribution. But when you come out of it and actually break it down and start to think about it, it doesn't, for me, make a lot of sense. It's one of those things where it's more emotionally satisfying than it is logically, and it kind of fell apart for me a little bit in the final third. But overall, I do love this film and I'd recommend people really go and see it. If you like Edgar Wright, this is something a bit different, but the same. And, you know, it's just so exhilarating in places.
Ashanti, did you like it?
I did. And I agree with Jamie. I have to say that I didn't mind the third act, though a lot of people who saw it had problems with it. Mm. And exactly as Jamie says, you know, those kind of flaws start to come in only at that point, because up until then, it is almost a flawless film. And I particularly was really interested in the people that Edgar chose to work with, because he worked with a Glaswegian. Her name is Christy Wilson Cairns, who did she worked on the screenplay with him. And I felt that female gaze that she brought to it was very important to this film, because it was set on, you know, on a young girl. And I really like that. I like that he worked with a woman to kind of create that narrative. And he also worked with a South Korean DOP for this. And this is the person who will be doing the Obi-Wan Kenobi series on Disney Plus, Chung Hoon Chung. And that cinematography really, I mean, it lifted London in a way I didn't think it could, because I went into the cinema and I saw it at the Regent Street Cinema, which is absolutely beautiful. And once the film started, because the posters looked so appealing, but once the film started, I saw that kind of layer that this cinematographer brought to fore. And I really liked that as well. And I think Anya Taylor-Joy she's a joy to watch. She just lights up the screen. So the minute, you know, this time travel almost happens, you see her coming in. And Thomasin McKenzie, she is absolutely brilliant in this. I think she brings all those beautiful nuances to the character. The only thing that jarred me a little bit was the fact that we didn't see multicultural London in the now of London parts of the film. Because when it goes to the 60s, it was very representative. But when it was in 2021 or 2020, whenever it was set in fashion school, there's only one black kid, and he's the only kid who is friends with her. He makes friends with her. So those things felt slightly, you know, weird to me. It felt like they hadn't worked so hard on getting what London really looks like today for those portions. So that's my only kind of quip with this film. But saying that, I think it's a fantastic, fantastic film. And certainly, as Jamie said, go watch it.
Yeah. I mean, unfortunately, I thought the boy that played that boy that you're talking about was one of the weakest things in it.
Yes.
And really sort of pulled me out of the film whenever he was on. He was so sort of gormless, both written and performed. that really didn't work for me. But I sort of felt the same way as you, Shanti. I thought that the 60s section was so vibrant and Anna Taylor-Joy so wonderful to watch, and Matt Smith as well as this odious, you know, incredibly charismatic but awful sort of ladies' man, shall we say, was so evocative and so well done that actually I wanted to spend more time there. And every time it flipped back to modern day, I was less satisfied. And I almost felt like the elements that are in this that we can't spoil that end up in the third act, I could have done without, and could have just done with following Sandy and what happened to her, and without that sort of hysterical element that happens in the third act. I think there's a wonderful film right there in itself. And as you say, Soho looks amazing. If you do live and work in London, you tromp through Soho, usually stinks, you know, generally dirty, piles of rubbish. You don't really look up ever. And this film just makes it look like Las Vegas. It's so alluring and bright and dangerous and exciting and all of those things. And also, I have to say, it's an absolute ode to Ginnells, isn't it? So many little alleyways and back passages who were a matron. I mean, even at the end, during the credits, we have all these lingering shots of these little passageways that litter Soho, that who knows what goes on down them and what adventures you could find down them. So from a sense of place and evocation, it was perfect for me. But I completely lost it by the third act and was kind of irritated by it.
We should say, obviously, that Edgar Wright knows Soho as well as anyone, really. But since he moved to London, he's been working there 20 years, still has offices there, sort of tromps around the streets every day, you know, been doing it for 20 years. So he's a good man to do this. And also, I mean, Ashanti mentioned the cinematography, Chung Hoon Chung, who we should also say he has shot all of the Park Chan-wook films.
Yes, which are beautiful.
Like The Handmaiden and Old Boy, so he really brings that kind of eye to it as well, that you often have this with cinema, that when you have someone coming into a scenario, a kind of outsider coming in, you know, be it an English director going to America and shooting a film in LA or something, they see things that people who live there every day maybe don't see, and their eye is drawn to it. So he brings a fantastic eye to it, and yeah, I could just look at this film. I could look at the visuals all day long. And the first scene where they go to 60 Soho, which you glimpse in the trailer, where she suddenly finds herself, you know, under
she
a giant...
She goes down a ginnel and it opens
comes
up.
Out, loads of people, you know, period cars, 1960s cars going by. There's a massive Thunderball billboard above the cinema. She sweeps into Café de Paris and she goes down the stairs, and it's the first time she meets Matt Smith. Well, she sees, Anya Taylor-Joy's character, Sandy, meet Matt Smith. And that sequence, which is about 10 minutes long, and I won't say more because I want people to discover it for themselves, but that sequence is one of the sequences of the year. It is just stunning, absolutely stunning.
Yeah, it's immaculate. So I think we can say that we would recommend people go and see this.
Definitely.
And also, we probably should mention, it's one of the final roles of Diana Rigg in this film as well. The last time we'll see her on screen. And she is interesting, isn't she?
Yeah,
we can not say
great.
More about her probably, but it is nice to see Diana Rigg in one of her final roles.
Yeah, she's great in it. And then you've got Terence Stamp as well and Rita Tushingham. You've got all of these kind of 60s icons floating around. Yeah, it's great.
So get your 60s party wear on. Go and see it. If you can see it at a theatre in Soho, all the better. That is Last Night in Soho, and it's out in cinemas on Friday. Right, so from two women in London to two women in New York.
Lots of people pass all the time.
It's easy for a Negro to pass for white. I'm not sure it'd be so simple for a white person to pass for color.
So you haven't ever thought to?
What?
You ever thought of passing?
No, why should I? I have everything I've ever wanted.
This is my husband, John Bellew. Does he know?
But you dislike Negroes, Mr. Bellew.
No, not at all. I hate them.
So this is Passing, Rebecca Hall's directorial debut, an adaptation of a Harlem Renaissance novel. Ashanti, tell us about Passing and what it's about.
This film is a film that I didn't know I needed to see until I saw it and really opened my eyes, because this idea of white passing, we're seeing it a lot. that word is thrown around a lot on social media, especially. And seeing this story, Rebecca Hall, like Jane said, has directed this. It's her directorial debut, which kind of surprised me, but also didn't surprise me, because the film, on one hand, is brilliant because it has all the makings of an important storyline. And it has Tessa Thompson and Ruth Negga in it, who are both brilliant actresses. What I felt was, as a directorial debut, I think that some of this film didn't quite work for me. I felt that it was a little flat as a movie overall. Saying that, though, brilliant subject line. We managed to learn about how you can pass as white. And, you know, back in the day, you know, this is 1929, where the novel of this this same name was written, was in New York, the Harlem Renaissance, and, you know, late 1920s, where it was dangerous to be a Black person in New York. And they do bring a lot of those kind of ideas into this film. It's all in black and white, which, again, was quite interesting, because, you know, I think they want you to blur that color line when you're watching this film and not say, oh gosh, she's white passing, that kind of thing. And this was really interesting, because these are about two friends, their childhood friends, who kind of meet again, and they find out a lot about their lives, and they explore what's going on the racial side of things in this film. And there's a brilliant cast in it. You know, you've got Alexander, how do you pronounce his name? Skarsgård. Skarsgård, that's it. Andre Holland, I didn't expect to see him in this film. And there's Benga Akinagbe in it as well. So this film has a really brilliant cast. I think that it is a film that should have worked more for me than it did. But saying that, it is a film that I feel that everyone should watch. So that would be my kind of take on it.
It's getting a lot of awards buzz about, and obviously the subject matter, you know, when we're talking about blackfishing and other sort of elements of race and appropriation of race, is incredibly pertinent now as it was back in the 20s. You know, one of these women passes for white and is married to an overt racist, and the other woman is living in black Harlem with a black husband and living that life. And it's how do these two women who come from the same background live, and what are the dangers that each of them are flirting with? And they both are up against dangers. Jamie, did you like it? Did it work for you?
I thought it was great. I've seen it twice, and I liked it the first time and I loved it the second time. You know, it looks absolutely beautiful. I think it's such an accomplished debut that Rebecca Hall brings such sort of poise and elegance to it all, and yet, you know, doesn't kind of like sanitize any of the themes, that they're really there. You can really feel it. It's obviously a very personal film for her, that, you know, she has this history in her family, which she didn't really know growing up. She just realized that her mother, who is Maria Ewing, the Detroit-born opera singer, she realized something was different about her mother. And when her mother picked her up from school and stuff, people always looked at her and said, wow, look at her, she's so exotic. They always use this word. And Rebecca Hall sort of thought, there's something not right here. And she sort of said to her mum, like, you know, have we got any black ancestry in our family? And her mum didn't really know and said, maybe, maybe not. And then she found out later on in life that she has indeed, that her grandfather on her maternal side was of African-American descent and was passing his whole life. So it is a very personal story to her. I think she's just brought it to the screen absolutely superbly. I mean, talking of kind of awards chatter, I think both of the leading actresses deserve nominations.
Absolutely.
I think Ruth
Negga,
she'd be up for supporting actor, and she's great. And I think Tessa Thompson is brilliant. Yes. In the leading role as well. They're just really great. And the other thing I liked about this film, and this is sort of more subtle, but it's kind of obviously about race, that is the main topic, but it's also kind of about how we all pass in life. Every single one of us shape our identities to best fit society and what people want of us. So there's things going on with gender and motherhood and marriage and kind of all these things, and how we have to kind of shape our personas so that we get accepted and we do well in life. So I found all of that really interesting as well.
It is all about the sort of liminal spaces in which we live, isn't it? You know, there's a sort of undercurrent of sexual identity as well going on here. Like, is there a sexual charge between these two friends? And then is there a sexual charge between, you know, one of them's husband and the other girl? all of that's going on, as well as women's place within society and what women should be doing in an afternoon on a hot summer's day in New York, all sorts of things going on. And that's what I think's so lovely about it. It's very austere, isn't it? And very still. And this flatness that I think you're talking about, Ashanti, I found that sort of hypnotic with the tinkling piano going on. And obviously in this very sort of old fashioned ratio as well. And the black and white, I just found it really hypnotic that I sort of was taking it in and not thinking about any of these subjects. But then afterwards, I couldn't stop thinking about it. And I was thinking, oh, that's really interesting. And it's made me think about that. And it's made me think about that. So I found it really, really satisfying as a film experience. And yeah, I agree, Jamie. I'd like to see both of those actors in the awards run. I think they're both brilliant because it's not what they say necessarily. It's what they present, which is just so interesting and so nuanced. So yeah, I absolutely loved this one.
And I love the Ruth Negga's character, who seems to have it all, that she's passing as white, so she's been living in Europe and she's obviously got money and riches and all these things she maybe thought she could only dream of. But she is the one really who is unhappy. And there's a sense in this film that she really misses that community she's left behind. And the reason she wants to get back in her friend's life, into Tessa Thompson's life, is to kind of re-embrace that world and go back to Harlem and have that friendship and those people around her and people who understand her. And there's a real sort of poignancy and sadness there as well.
I'm going to see this again now that I've heard what you've had to say, because for me, that the repetitive piano arpeggio again and again, for me, it just was grating on me, and something about it just didn't work. But I've now heard what you have to say, and like Jamie's seen it twice, I think I'm going to give it another watch before voting in the awards, because for me, the actresses were standout for sure, but the rest of the film didn't quite come together. But you've both convinced me to see it again.
I don't know why it was on the second viewing it really hit me. The first one, I kind of admired it and loved the look of it, and I wasn't really into it emotionally. I was just kind of watching it from afar. And the second time, I just totally entered that world. And I was there in Harlem and I was at the dances. It just absolutely enveloped me the second time. So I would recommend giving it another look.
Yeah, definitely. And also, Alexander Skarsgård, once again, doing great bastard. Oh. I mean, this guy, just, I love it. He just is amazing. And obviously, I love the fact as well that Rebecca Hall was in Godzilla with him and whilst they were filming Godzilla, just sort of nudged, oh, Alexander, would you take a look at this? You fancy being in this? So yeah, to go from Godzilla to this thing of absolute beauty, this small, perfectly crafted, like a little pearl. That's how I feel of it. It's like a pearl that has been sort of nurtured in this oyster by Rebecca Hall. And it's this beautiful, lustrous thing now.
It's mad. It's taken her 13 years to make it. She read the book in her mid-20s and immediately wrote a screenplay because she wanted to better understand the book and how it's kind of resonated with her own life. So almost as an exercise, she wrote a screenplay. And then for 13 years, she didn't quite have the courage to make it because it's such a hot button topic and so ambitious for a debut and obviously hard to raise the money. So it's taken her 13 years and now here she finally is with, you know, one hell of a debut that is getting awards talk. So
when I talked to her about this, she was so eloquent and so self-reflective. It was wonderful to talk to her and she was a really interesting chat. But she said that the thing that had taken her the longest to sort of get to directing was that she thought it was an act of ego to even direct, and she didn't feel like she could do that. And then she was like, well, sod it. No, why am I letting, like the characters in this book, some societal definition of me hold me back? I'm going to be ego about this, and I'm going to go and I'm going to say I have a story to tell, and here, and off I go. And I'm really glad she did. I think it's a wonderful thing, and I'm really excited to see what she does next. Okay, so that is Passing, which is out in cinemas on Friday. Okay, so now it's time for Plain Talking, where we demystify the chat that's on set, and this week we're talking about flag on play. Jamie, do you know what flag on play means?
I'm not familiar with the term flag on play, but I am familiar with flag in film terms. That flag is the, like, when they put up almost like a barrier. I don't know how to describe it, like a barrier or a filter, a block, which kind of blocks the light. So it's great for making shadows and sort of filling in spaces and stuff. Whenever you go on a film set and you'll see it, you know, if you used to watch Barry Norman and you saw set reports or something, they have those big art lights on yes. set, and then they always have a sort of board by it where they're like reflecting the light and angling the light. And that is a flag. So I imagine flag on play is probably what someone shouts when they're ready to go, and they say, right, the flag's ready, off we go. I mean, but I'm guessing, is that right?
It's interesting. I'm enjoying all that flag talk. But when I've heard it, it's because when people said cut and moving on, somebody's gone, uh-oh, no, hang on. Something wasn't right. We need to redo it. So flag on play, right. As in don't start packing up, don't start moving on. We need to do this again because audio was out, or, you know, continuity was wrong, or somebody didn't say a line quite right. And just before we move on and finish that particular scene, we need to get this right. So it's like a golfing thing, I guess, that the flag is still on the... I don't know golfing at all. I don't know why I'm saying that. No idea. No. Do you say that there's a flag on playing golfing? But anyway, the idea being that, hang on, we're still going. Don't move on. This is still happening. So it's nearly Halloween time. It's time to get spooked, I think. Shall we move on to our next film? It's this.
What's going on?
We found a part of a man in the woods today.
Part of the man?
I guess the other half was found in the mine. Well, this has got to be an animal, right? No animal that I've ever seen.
So this is Antlers. Jamie, tell us about it. Why should you be scared of antlers?
Well, it's set in a small town in Oregon, America, and it's about Julia, who is an elementary school teacher, played by Kerry Russell, and she's living with her cop brother, played by Jesse Plemons, and she's at her school, and she's worried about one of her young pupils. She's worried about his welfare, basically, that he seems very neglected, maybe abused, coming into school, and she kind of fears what's going on in his home. So she starts to investigate a little bit, drops by his house, etc. And what she discovers goes beyond her wildest nightmares. I won't say more than that. Mm. It's essentially a horror movie, a creature feature. It's directed by Scott Cooper. It's his first horror film. He's the guy you're probably known from Crazy Hearts was his debut. Yeah. With Jeff Bridges, and he's done Out of the Furnace and Hostile.
Love Out of the Furnace.
And Black Mass. And his films are normally all about masculinity, and they're always set in kind of blue collar environments, Rust Belt America. And he again brings that to this, you know, it's a very poor area, and there's metaphors going on here with the creature, but it's a sort of metaphor for the opioid epidemic going on in America. There's a lot going on here, but I have to say I was quite disappointed with it. I like Scott Cooper, and I was excited about him making a horror movie because I love my horror movies, and I thought that he'd really bring something new to the genre, his eye. You know, you often get, be it Kubrick with The Shining or Werner Herzog with Nosferatu, when you get directors, sort of name directors moving into the horror genre, they often bring something and they do something different. But this felt to me quite rote, that I'd kind of seen it all before. I did like the community he conjures up, but he's very good at that. Like I said, the sort of derelict buildings, the kind of poverty, you kind of feel all of that. But in terms of the characters and in terms of the creature and in terms of the horror elements, I didn't really think it was all that, to be honest. And we've been waiting a long time for it because it's been postponed twice with the pandemic. So that kind of adds to the hype. Anyone who's been looking forward to it like I have, it's sort of like, oh, not postponed again. And finally it's here. And I was just a bit like, oh, is that it? Okay.
Ashanti, how was it for you? I mean, you're not a great fan of a horror film, so it's a bit mean of me to have given this to you. I thought that after. I was like, oh, just watch this. And then I was like, oh, man, she's not going to love this. What did you think?
Ever since I met you, Jane, I think I've opened my eyes to this genre, which I had been avoiding. And I felt it was necessary for me to get into it because there's so many good horror films coming out. And this one, it's adapted from a short story. And this young boy, Lucas Weaver, his name is in this, Jeremy T. Thomas. I have to say, give him some awards.
Oh, he's so good.
so good in this. You know, he just draws you in. That face, he's just got this, you know, super cute face, and you know the way he brings out that character. And for me, the word I can use, and it's a very colloquial word, is that I was just shook. I was watching this film because there's a lot of graphical stuff, and on top of the graphical stuff was the sound design of the film. Mm-hmm. Which, you know, they take you from the highs to the lows very quickly. And when those high sounds come in, they are really, really scary. And you're hearing this malevolent thing, you know, that's obviously eating people. And it's quite, quite freaky and scary. And, you know, I felt that, like Jamie said, there's lots of layers to this film that are not very obvious, but I like the way they brought it together. And I was, you know, quite interested in that, because obviously the indigenous people of America have had a lot of travesties against them and their beliefs and all of that. And, you know, that kind of allegory of deeper horror against humanity coming through in this film, I thought worked very well for it. I think when a film is associated with Guillermo del Toro, you're expecting certain things. And I think that might be why Jamie was not as impressed with the film. Whereas for me, because I come into the horror genre without watching too many horror films in my lifetime, I probably was a little bit more impressed by it. And, you know, there's layers of childhood bullying, because this boy is obviously taking care of himself. He's poor. He's, you know, his little brother and his father are the only people who were in his life. And I don't want to tell you what else goes on behind the scenes, because I'll spoil it for you. But I thought it was quite a masterpiece in this genre. And the fact that they brought out many things about indigenous people without throwing it in your face, and seeing it all through the eyes of this boy who's just kind of trying to live his life. You know, he just wants to survive. Mm-hmm. And that for me really worked. But yes, sound design was so on point. I think they took so much care with it. I have to say that with horror films nowadays, I think maybe back in the day they were like Saw, where they were really just overtly scary, not much going on in the backdrop. But, you know, now that I've seen some of these new horror films that are telling you a deeper human horror story, I think I'm getting into that genre. I feel like my husband's really surprised.
Well, it's that sort of thing, isn't it? That horror allows you to tell a story via a sort of genre that you may not want to watch, or it might feel dry or preachy or whatever it is, if it was just given to you as is. There's, as you say, this idea about indigenous people being, you know, their lands being taken. And there's also eco things in here. There's, as you say, about the opioid epidemic. There's also, you know, the fact that great parts of America are, you know, their industry has gone, there is no work, what do people do? Loads of interesting things there. But I have to say, I sort of have to agree with Jamie on this. I felt like it started out super intriguing and super interesting, and I thought it was going in one direction, and I was like, it's not just going to be that, it is just that. So it felt as though the potential was far greater than the actual end point, and the journey halfway through was more exciting than the destination of the end. I'm sort of half and half on it. I think also agree with you, Ashanti, the production and the sort of the lensing of it, the sound design, you know, the acting. Jesse Plemons never bad in anything. Another sort of cop role for him, bumbling along. I'm surprised he wasn't holding a donut, but, you know, like, I really enjoyed all of that sort of putting you in a place and understanding people with very few lines, just understanding that this had happened to this person and this person was struggling with this. It was very artfully done. Unfortunately, the whole story didn't work for me. However, you know, for Halloween, if you've already seen Michael Myers, you know, with no subtlety whatsoever or nuance, slashing and burning his way through Haddonfield, this might be a really nice sort of intriguing and layered scare for you on a Halloween weekend.
It is also, like Ashanti said, it's pretty hardcore as well. The gore is quite graphic as well, so beware of that. If that's something that frightens you off or you can't cope with, you may want to hide behind the sofa. It doesn't hold back.
It doesn't. Okay, so that is Antlers, and we won't say how Antlers get into it, but it's not nice, which is out in cinemas on Friday. Right, it's time for alternative line reading. Here's one that is horror and also connected to a film that we're reviewing this week. So what shall I do it in the style of? I don't know. I'd like to do it in Sean Bean again, but I've done Sean Bean to death, haven't I? It's my staple. I don't know. I'll just do it as me, I think. I might do it as tired me, because I am. I don't think I've got it in me to shoot my flatmate, my mum and my girlfriend all in the same evening.
I think I know that.
What is it?
But Ashanti's got her hand up and she's desperate, so I'm going to let her say
it. Yes, go on. She's like that kid at school. Go on.
Yes.
Go on, Ashanti. Go.
Put my hand up. You know what? Surprisingly, I actually know this one because my hobby made me watch the film Shaun of the Dead.
Exactly. And that's quite scary too. You're doing all right with your scary films. It is Shaun of the Dead, and this is what it sounds like.
Do you know, I don't think I've got it in me to shoot my flatmate, my mum and my girlfriend all in the same evening.
Okay, time to discover a little bit more about St. Vincent.
Let's start at the beginning. It was supposed to be a music documentary, concert footage, interviews, you know. I wanted people to know who I really am, so I asked my best friend to direct it.
We're gonna film everything. Just be yourself.
I love you!
I was hoping to get a little after show footage.
Y'all just did. Double word score.
Damn it.
Read 'em and weep.
You're nerdy and normal in real life, but the disparity between that and who you are on stage is jarring.
So this is The Nowhere Inn, which is a documentary of sorts about the musician St. Vincent. But is it? Is it not? Who knows? Ashanti, what is this about? I mean, so I think that's the biggest question of all, but go on, have a go.
So you will only really know what this is about when you see this film. It's described as a mockumentary, a psychological thriller, a rockumentary also. This one is about a musician called St. Vincent. Now, let me just say that the first scene in this film itself, well, a lot of you who don't know her, like I didn't know her, I'd not heard of her, though she's won, you know, she won 2 Grammys. But rock is not my genre, so I hadn't picked up on that. But, you know, right at the start, she's in this limousine and a driver asks her who she is, says, I'm supposedly driving someone famous, but I've never heard of you. And that's exactly how I felt. I'd never heard of St. Vincent. And it turns out she is this brilliant musician. But this film is, and I'm really scared to give away spoilers for this because it is a musical kind of documentary in that sense, but it's a musical mockumentary and a rockumentary and all of that. She hires this polymath, Carrie Brownstein, who's a close friend of hers, and says to her, look, can you direct a documentary around my life? And what happens after that is the fact that she gets sucked into this perfect world we're seeing everywhere. We can all relate to this film because we're seeing it in, you know, on TikTok and on Instagram. Everything is so uber curated. And here's a woman who's decided at one point she overhears someone saying her life is so boring. All she is a musician on stage. And then she decides, I'm going to change all of it and create a life I want to show the world. And it's true, I say to a lot of people quite often that what looks really glossy on my social media, behind the scenes, there's a lot of battles that I personally go through that you don't see and you'll never hear about unless you sit and talk to me or you ask me about it, because otherwise it just looks glossy, right? It's got a nicely edited photo of me smiling in front of something.
Delicious food, generally.
Delicious food.
Yeah, if you go to Shanti's social media, don't go on an empty stomach is all I'll say.
So true. And so what happens with this is the fact that I feel like it's a mirror of the world we're living in right now. And I went into this film really not knowing anything about St. Vincent or her life or anything about this film. It wasn't even on my radar till Jane had told me to watch it. But when I saw it, you know, there was a lot in this film. You know, you've got some very big stars in this film. Mm-hmm. You've got this LGBTQ angle that, again, surprised me and made me feel really happy that it was being shown in this way with a very female gaze to it, which I personally did like, though it's not a woman who's directed this film, I felt that there's a lot going on with Carrie and with St. Vincent herself. And yes, all I can say is that it's a film that you need to watch to really understand and, you know, go.
It's very hard to describe, isn't it?
It's hard to describe, but it does give you a lot of good music. So for me, though I say I'm not into rock, I was so, the musicality that Annie Erin Clark, aka St. Vincent, brings to you really, really grasped me. So I was actually looking forward to watching more of her in her musical zone than actually in the film zone that they were trying to show. But yeah, this kind of blurs the line between documentaries and mockumentaries, and it has a few laughs to it as well. And I quite like the way they did this. It's a surprise film that I didn't think I would like as much as I did.
Mm. Yeah, I mean, I am a fan of St. Vincent. I love her work. And I'm also very aware of her persona, which is this beautiful woman in huge heels wearing a skin tight outfit with a guitar rocking out. And she has this sort of aloofness to her. And that's the sort of person she presents on stage. So I found this bewildering and quite annoying that I didn't get to see what she really was like, because really what she does with this for me is that persona is then enveloped in another persona in this film. And it's a film that questions who we present to the world, has quite a lot in common with Passing in a way, because it's about, you know, where we exist in the world and how we exist for other people and how people view us and what we choose to show and what we choose to hide. And that sounds very highfalutin, but it's actually kind of weird. And I would have liked to have seen more of her just playing music, because she has fantastic songs and she's a wonderful performer. And those are very small snippets. But I do like the sort of the sense of humour that she's obviously exhibiting here, that she plays with aspects of her life that have been widely reported in the music press. You know, her father being in prison, her sexuality and who she is having sex with and her famous girlfriends. And she plays with all of that in a playful way, which sort of is at odds with the persona she has on stage. Jamie, did you like it?
I found it really interesting. Everything you said, I found fascinating, and how it kind of shows the artificiality of everything. It, you know, be it the personas we present on social media, or be it, you know, how artificial the music industry is, and also how documentary filmmaking, you know, isn't necessarily the truth. It's still what you choose to show, and it's all curated, you know, that you angle the lens this way and not that way. So you're still telling a story. So all of that was kind of swirling in it, which I found interesting. And a difference between St. Vincent, her onstage persona, and Annie Clark, you know, who she really is offstage, who is presented in this film as someone who's just very, very sort of boring, for want of a better word, you know, that she is just a normal person who's quite quiet and just goes about her business. And then she feels she needs to kind of up everything and put a performance on for this documentary because she's worried people will find her too boring. So I found it all interesting, but I didn't love it. I kind of felt, I don't know, it's hard to describe, but I felt it was quite obvious in a way and quite superficial in a way, which is maybe the point considering the themes we're dealing with, but it maybe didn't dig deep enough. Like you said, Jane, I actually wanted to know more about Annie Clark, you know, the real person she is, which you sort of get glimpses of at the beginning, and then it's all kind of camouflaged and hidden. And again, for me, the best bits of it are the onstage moments. The bits, you know, there are several rock moments where it's just her performing on stage. And like Ashanti, I don't really know St. Vincent. I'm not up on her. I don't know her music. I'd heard of her. But just seeing her in those outfits on stage and just the strut and the swagger with the guitar, you know, I thought that was electric. So there's pockets in this film I really enjoyed. But as an overall experience, I was kind of a little bit meh about it.
Yeah, it's weird because it's like, I don't know if it's for St. Vincent fans or not for St. Vincent fans is very difficult to tell. But she is an intriguing character, and this will only enhance that idea of her. I mean, and in a sort of Bowie-esque way that she tries on different images and personas and plays with that and manipulates that. I guess if you are a fan of her, then this is just another extension of that and what she does with her art on records and on stage. Also, I have to say, Dakota Johnson turns up in this, and I met Dakota last week to have a chat with her about one of her films and was so surprised at her sense of humour. I don't think we've seen that in film. So to see her here also being completely game to be silly, it really made me warm to her. And what lingerie is all I'll say. Great lingerie in this.
I'm going to echo you, Jane. My gosh, she looked stunning in this. Wow.
Yes. And she's funny and playful and goofy. So, yeah. So there's, you know, two great women who are being silly in this that I enjoyed. OK, so would we recommend this for people to go and see at the cinema?
I would say not. It's one of those films that I'd say maybe isn't worth your time to go to a cinema to, you know, actually make the journey, make the time. When it comes round on streaming, whatever, I would certainly say give it a go. You know, it's a film I would love to watch on a Wednesday night with my tea, but if I gave up a whole night to go out, you know, trek 10 miles to a cinema or whatever, I'd maybe be a bit disappointed. That's my take.
And is it going to make you to go and listen to some St. Vincent records?
Yes, it does do that for me. I definitely want to get into her music.
Yeah.
I certainly will be listening to more of her music and kind of follow her on socials just to see what else she's kind of presenting about herself. Yes, with this film, I would say it's one of those films that you can watch at home.
There we go. That's a nice way to say it. That is the Nowhere Inn. I don't think the Nowhere Inn even crops up in the film. So that's also an artifice. The Nowhere Inn, which is out in cinemas on Friday. Okay, that's it for this week. Had a little bit of horror, a little bit of performance art, a little bit of beautiful black and white, and a little bit of Soho. What's your film of the week, Jamie?
My film of the week, it's a real toss-up between Last Night in Soho and Passing. I think Passing is probably the best film there and the one that would really, really sort of be up for awards and stand the test of time. But Last Night in Soho is the one I'd go to on a Friday night for a rollicking good night at the movies.
Last Night in Solo is like, is a porn film that's like Star Wars themed. Anyway,
that's something I'm trying to get Edgar to make. But
there you go. You can pitch that to him from me. Ashanti, what's your film of the week?
Definitely Last Night in Soho. Mm-hmm. Hands down. I think that film has everything you need on that Friday night, on that weekend that you want to see. Plus, the release has been timed very close to Halloween, which... I think
works.
Very smart.
Yes. Well, mine would be Passing. I think it's beautiful. And I could listen to that piano all day. Okay, it's time to go. But before we do, we have a reader's question, and it's apt for Halloween. What's a scary moment in film that still gets you every time? Ashanti.
For me, it's in the film Get Out, Jordan Peele's Get Out, which had lots of scary moments. And it was one of those early horror films that I went to see in the cinema, because back then I was really avoiding them. But with this, there was so much I could resonate with the storyline and went with my hubby. And most of the audience in the cinema also, it was at the Cineworld O2, were Black people. So they could all resonate with this film. We could hear the gasps and audience reactions, which felt really good. And in this, there's the auction scene, which just freaks you out. It's not overtly scary in the sense that it's not like they're chucking, you know, blood at you, but the kind of feels that you get watching that, I would say that's the one. It's like history repeated. It's horror. It's all in that one scene. And I thought it was quite genius, but also really scary.
Mm-hmm. Jamie, you obviously love your scares. Is the one that always works.
But Ashanti's gone for a really insidious moment, which, again, I love that moment as well. So I'm going to go the opposite and go for some sort of jump scares, which I think the jump scare is often sort of derided as a cheap device, you know, a blare of music and something happening suddenly, but it's easy to do. But it is hard to do it well and to do it, you know, extraordinarily well. And So I'm going to go for a couple. I'm going to go for the end of the original Friday the 13th, mm-hmm. when in that film, the killer is actually Mrs. Voorhees, not Jason Voorhees, but right at the end, child Jason, who's been drowned. He's been in the lake for ages and he's all kind of mangled and rotting and messed up. He leaps out the lake. He sort of plunges into a small boat to grab the lone survivor at the end of a film. When you think it's all over, it's one of those moments like The Hand from the Grave in Carrie, where it's finished, but it hasn't finished. And the timing of that scale, I've watched it many, many times, and just the timing of him coming out of the lake, they must have shot that, like, either got very lucky or shot it 500 times and chosen the perfect one, because it just gets me every single time. I'm also going for the head rolling out the boat in Jaws.
Oh, Bed Gardner's. Yes, every time.
That's another one. You know it's coming, but it gets you. And
but
Spielberg,
it's the sound design on that as well.
Oh, it's brilliant. And I love the fact that Spielberg shot that in his swimming pool as well, but he didn't have that scene and he went back and did it and put some milk in the swimming pool to get that sort of phosphorescent look of the seawater.
I bet his pool guy wasn't happy.
Probably not.
What have you been putting in it, Mr. Spielberg? Milk, you say?
Semi-skim milk. And then I'm going to be greedy and go for a third one, because I have to mention my favourite horror film of all time and my favourite scare of all time, Texas Chainsaw Massacre. And the first time Leatherface appears, when he suddenly comes flying out from behind the iron door, just shoves a mallet on someone's head, grabs him, pulls him behind the door and slams the metal door shut. And it all happens in 2 seconds, quite deep into the film, probably 30, 40 minutes into the film. And you just watch it and go, what the hell did I just see? It's over so quick and it resonates. And I still have nightmares about it. I often actually have a dream where that happens to me. I go into Leatherface's house and get a mallet over the head and get dragged behind the door.
You know, you can go into Leatherface's house because
you've done it.
It's now a cafe in Texas. The toilets are through that door. So,
oh my God, I don't think I could.
Jamie,
I'd
have
a heart attack.
Yeah,
I'd have a heart attack.
It's still completely unchanged. You eat your lunch in the the family lounge, and then the toilets are through Leatherface's horrible door.
But what's in your lunch, Jane? It's going to be human meat, isn't it? Cannibals.
Head cheese.
What's yours, Jane? What's your scary moment?
I think it's probably still, and it's not a horror thing, but it just gets me every time. The Child Catcher in Chitty Chitty Bang Bang. Dancing down the street in that truck with his lollipops all free today. And you know that those kids should not go out there. And he goes down to the grate and he's upside down and he goes, lollipops all free today, with his horrible nose and his beady eyes and his lank hair. And oh no, it's still, even just thinking about it now, makes me so scared. I don't like it. So it's not really a jump scare. It's more of just an insidious.
Just for a name drop here, didn't you recently interview Kenneth Branagh, and he loved Child Catcher as well, but that was one of his formative scares.
We bonded over Chitty Chitty Bang Bang. So that's what, you know, I'm glad that it wasn't, I didn't have to, you know my Shakespeare. It was Chitty Chitty Bang Bang that Kenneth and I were talking about. So yes, that is a good name drop. Clonk. Okay, we will be back next week with more reviews of the week's releases, but for now I think it's time to say goodbye. So happy Halloween, everyone, and say goodbye, Jamie.
Goodbye, happy Halloween.
And Ashanti,
happy Halloween, see you soon.
Goodbye. Goodbye.